Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Monty Python, the legendary comic act of silliness and subversion, inspired legions of fans across the globe to recite its lines verbatim. Think, your mother was a hamster and your father smelt of elderberries, or bring us a shrubbery, we are the knights who say knee. For four wild seasons, starting in 1969, they brought their sketch comedy to the BBC and then on to America and to the big screen with And Now for Something Completely Different, Monty Python's The Meaning of Life and more. Comedian and actor Michael Palin was at the heart of it all with John Cleese, Sarah Keitel, and the rest of the crew. Now he's published his diary of those years and relationships. This hour, On Point, writer and actor Michael Palin on the creation and fame of Monty Python and the Monty Python years. Joining me now from New York is Michael Palin, celebrated writer and actor. He cemented his fame with Monty Python and went on to a prominent career in TV and film post-Python, including his appearance in A Fish Called Wanda. He's also made a series of travel documentaries and accompanying travel books. Now he's out with his diaries, 1969 to 1979, The Python Years. Michael Palin, thanks very much for being with us.
Nice to be here. Nice to be here, Tom. Thanks.
I guess we all like to look back at some point, but you waited a long time to look back to those years to let us read your diaries. What took you so long?
Well, because they were private, really, in a way, as a diary is. And they involve not just other Pythons, but obviously there's my family are in there as well. And I was quite happy just to have assembled the material without any idea of publishing it. But the kind of enduring success of Python, the fact it's still around, that there are people, you know, 9 and 10-year-olds now discovering the Holy Grail and all that, made me think, well, actually, they may be interested in what it was actually like at the time. And I'm certainly interested when I look back at the diaries, because they're written without hindsight. Mm-hmm. You know, you rush to judgment sometimes. You're quite intemperate sometimes. You make a decision or judgment about somebody. It's completely wrong 2 days later. But this is the really authentic feeling of what I was going through in those years when we were creating Python and what our hopes were for it and where it started and where it began.
It gets hailed as genius and revolution now. We'll ask what you thought of it at the time, but let's get the sound of it in our ears. Michael Palin, here's one of your sketches, John Cleese trying to purchase some cheese from you, Michael Palin. You're playing the shopkeeper, but you're standing over an empty counter. Let's listen.
Certainly, sir. What would you like?
Well, how about a little Red Leicester?
I'm afraid we're fresh out of Red Leicester, sir.
Never mind. How are you on Tilsit?
Never at the end of the week, sir. Always get it fresh first thing on Monday.
Tish, tish. No matter. Well, 4 ounces of Caerphilly, then, if you please, stout yeoman.
Ah, well, it's been on order for 2 weeks, sir. I was expecting it this morning.
Yes, it's not my day, is it? Belpaese?
Sorry.
Red Windsor?
Normally, sir, yes. But today the van broke down.
Stilton?
Sorry.
Gruyere, Emmental?
No.
Any Norwegian Jarlsberger?
No.
Liptauer?
No.
Lancashire?
No.
White Stilton?
No.
The cheesemonger, Michael Palin, there, giving John Cleese nothing. The cheesemonger with the empty counter, and I don't know what, some kind of Korean banjo in the background it sounded like.
It's Mexican. Oh, no, Greek actually,
okay,
Greek. Yes,
okay.
Greek dancing.
It's only
at the very end of the sketch that John says, will you shut that bloody noise up?
I don't know what I'm hearing there. And I suppose a lot of people didn't know exactly what they were hearing. What did you think of what you were doing? Did you think you were, you know, blowing up the world of comedy and introducing something brand new?
No. to be honest. We just thought we were doing something which had a different shape and form from other comedy shows, but basically owed much to things like The Goon Show, Beyond the Fringe, things we'd grown up with. What really made, I think, Python different was that we were six writers and performers who created the show. There were no outside writers. There was no executive producer saying, you've got to write this, you've got to write that.
Right, so Cleese, you, Eric Idle, Terry Jones, Graham Chapman, Terry Gilliam. You.
Yeah. Yes. That. I mean, we really were left to create it ourselves. And obviously, you know, if it failed, we failed. And the BBC didn't help a lot to start with. They gave us the series, for which we were duly grateful, but they gave us a very, very tight budget. They would take the show off on Sunday night if there was something else that they wanted to show. So we were treated pretty much like the lowest of the low for about a season.
Well, when you say you were in a kind of tradition, the Goon Show, Peter Sellers, and the rest, how do you define that tradition then? I mean, people talk about Monty Python having been freeform, nonlinear, you know, very sarcastic, satirical, anarchic. Was there a mold that you felt yourself fitting into, or were you trying to break the mold?
We were trying to do as much as we could. And all different styles. So we had some surreal Spike Milligan kind of humor in there. I very often played sort of Peter Sellers-like characters, those little sort of little men he used to play that used to irritate authority figures and all that. So there was a bit of Sellers there. Terry Gilliam, on the other hand, the American Python, was doing this very good sort of state-of-the-art modern kind of animation. John and Graham were writing occasionally slightly harder material. John could blow his top wonderfully and make it funny at the same time in a way that no one else could. So actually, what I suppose, rather than self-consciously fitting into molds or breaking molds, we just wanted to bring everything to the table, every kind of humour that we could use that would make the rest of us laugh, and then assemble this in a show and hope that, let's see what the reaction is out there. Who's going to be listening? What kind of reaction are we going to get? And we honestly really didn't know to start with. And I think that would be unusual now, because it probably would be that much more market research would go into something like Python.
No question. You and Terry Jones had kind of been in the world of comedy and performance at Oxford. Chapman, John Cleese, Idle at Cambridge. Had you honed your this style there, or was this a twist for all of you?
Well, no, I think it was very important, the university years, because both Oxford and Cambridge have a very strong tradition of review and people getting up on stage, usually with something they've written themselves, and performing it. And so as a sort of training for writing and performance, those university clubs were really very, very important. And I remember going to the Edinburgh Festival in 1964, the Oxford Review, and Terry was one of the cast, I was one of the cast, there were three others in it. And to me, this was, for the first time in my life, a moment when I realised that perhaps I could earn a living from writing and performing. Up till that time, I thought, well, it's a university thing, I'll end up going in a bank or doing advertising or maybe a bit of journalism. But from Edinburgh, where we got an international audience, we got a paying audience, we sold out every night, right. We had to do extra performances at midnight, you know. I suddenly realized this is not only fun, but we actually were quite good at it. I think that was, the university experience was very, very important. We changed, you know, when we worked with Terry and John, with Graham and John, and with Terry Gilliam, and with Eric Idle, we changed some of the material, obviously. But the basic sort of instinct to write and perform your own material, to be protective of what you could do yourself, was laid down at university.
Here's a sketch from 1970, Michael Palin with us today, then playing a man who's just lost his wallet and approaches John Cleese, who plays a police officer. We want to hear maybe how you come up with this.
Inspector,
mm-hmm.
I'm terribly sorry, but I was sitting on a park bench over there, took my coat off for a minute, and then I found my wallet had been stolen and £15 taken from it.
Well, did you see anyone take it? Anyone hanging around? Or?
No, there was no one there at all. It's trouble.
Well, there's not very much we can do about that, sir.
Oh, Do you want to come back to my place? Yeah, all right.
Okay. Okay, where do you come up with that? With the ramp and then the twist?
I don't know. I mean, I can't remember whether that was improvised while we were out filming. I remember we did it in this extraordinary little northern town on a kind of corner of a street with John standing there as this high-ranking policeman with a big sort of cap on all that. I don't know. Maybe, do you want to come back to my place? It had been something, it was a sort of the gay scene was beginning to develop in England at the time. Maybe there was some key phrase like
that. A shtick line to
drop. So we thought, well, let's put this in the most unlikely situation with two men who are clearly very, very normal and ordinary and just play the twist. And really, the two nice, what I like about it is that we both play it very, very straight. It's just one of those ordinary things that happens. And then suddenly you've got this double whammy. And, you want to come back to my place? And then, you know, think shock, horror. What's going to happen? Yeah, all right. You know, just,
why not?
It's a nicely played one there. Right?
Mm. And suddenly we're in the Monty Python universe there. We're talking this out with British comedian and actor and former Monty Python great Michael Palin. He's out with Diaries, 1969 to 1979, the Python years. Here's an early Monty Python sketch with Michael Palin playing a mild-mannered accountant. He visits a vocational guidance counselor and reveals his true professional ambitions to John Cleese.
Do you have any idea of what you want to do?
Yes. Yes, I have.
What?
Lion taming!
Yes. Of course, it's a bit of a jump, isn't it? I mean, chartered accountancy to lion taming in one go. You don't think it might be better if you worked your way towards lion taming, say, via banking?
No, I don't want to wait. But 9 o'clock tomorrow, I want to be in there taming.
Fine. But do you have any qualifications?
Yes, I've got a hat.
A hat?
Yes, a hat. A lion taming hat. A hat with lion tamer on it. I got it at Harrods.
Michael Palin and John Cleese there in The Lion Tamer. I mean, here's another. You note in your diaries, Michael Palin, that, you know, the origin of many of the most famous sketches, the Spanish Inquisition, Silly Walks of all things. You didn't really record in your diary. You weren't taking it down as though these were, you know, great developments step by step. But what about this one? I mean, do you recall the way it emerged at all?
I remember it was a sketch written by John and Graham, and they were really top script writers at the time, sketch writers. I'd first seen their material on the Frost Report, and this is I seem to remember them coming up with that, and a lovely part for me to play, absolutely lovely. You know, someone who goes from being extremely boring to being extremely crazed and revealing all the different levels in a character, which I really, really enjoyed. And also what I like about hearing that is how it brings back how pleasant it was working with John. You know, he was so good at timing pauses, so good at coming in strongly on lines to get the... I mean, I think we both felt we had to get the maximum out of a sketch like that. And it's not something you can pin down. There's no sort of list of how to make people laugh. It's just something in very much in the rhythm sometimes. It's in timing. And John had it just so effortlessly. And I think we played off each other well.
And, of course, the very idea of the accountant who wants to be the lion tamer. Michael Palin, we've got a lot of people who want to talk with you. Let me go to some, if I may. In Albuquerque, New Mexico, Tom is calling. Tom, you're on the air with Michael Palin.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, Tom.
Glad to talk to you. I was just wanting to share a very fond memory that I laugh about often related to Life of Brian. I grew up as a preacher's kid in Buckle of the Bible Belt, and when that movie came out in that community, there was a great amount of uprise about it, of how just horrible it was. And I came home. I was a college student. My father said, "Tom, let's go." And we went, and there were protesters, and we went into the theater, and I don't know when the two of us have laughed so hard. And it taught me, I think, a very wonderful lesson about faith. I'm a pastor myself, kind of in the footsteps.
Yes.
And that sense that one can, that, I don't know, it just, It was a very it was a fun time.
But Tom, you're a pastor, so was terrific. Your dad. This was kind of a send up of Jesus banned in Ireland. Did it not look like sacrilege to you?
No, because I think God's bigger than that. I think God trusts him too, and the pieces on it, and just it was just I found absolutely delightful. And I think if one can't look at the things one believes and not at times laugh at them, if we put it up on a pedestal where it's away from even just thinking about, or I don't know, I just found it delightful.
Tom, that's wonderful, Mike.
That's very really. Now that's nice to hear because. I mean, we didn't go into that lightly. We didn't say, well, we're just going to make lots of jokes about Jesus and his life. It was about why people follow certain people and what they will... that's also an authority, what an authority can do to people who don't think it through. And it was never intended to be anything, that was anti-Jesus or people's faith in Jesus. As you say, if you've got a faith that's strong enough to withstand something like Python. But also, Jesus was as far as we were concerned, good guy doing all the right things, and he was quite subversive himself at the time. It was all about people who just believe without thinking.
1978, Monty Python's Life of Brian, the story of Brian Cohen, born on the same street as Jesus. Tom in Albuquerque, thanks for your call, but let's listen to a little bit there. Here's Michael Palin, who played a begging ex-leper in Life of Brian, who's irritated that he's been cured.
All right, sir, my fine lover, I'll check up on our ex-leper.
Did you say ex-leper?
That's right, sir. 16 years behind a bell, I'm proud of you, sir.
Well, what happened?
Oh, cured, sir.
Cured?
Yes, a bloody miracle, sir. God bless you.
Well, who cured you?
Jesus did, sir. I was hopping along, minding my own business. All of a sudden, up he comes, cures me. One minute I'm a leper with a trade, next minute my livelihood's gone. Not so much as a by your leave. You're cured, mate. Bloody do-gooder.
Well, why don't you go and tell him that you want to be a leper again?
Oh, I could do that, sir, yeah. Yeah, I could do that, I suppose. What I was thinking, I was going to ask him if he'd make me a bit lame in one leg during the middle of the week. Something beggable, but not leprosy.
1 minute I'm a leper with a trade, next minute my livelihood's gone, not so much as a bite. Bloody do-gooder, oh my goodness. Let's take a call from Gertie in Montauk on Long Island. Hi, Gertie, you're on the air.
Ah. Hi, gentlemen. Thank you, Monty Python, for wonderful memories, wonderful graphics, and I too would like to comment on the life of Brian. I had a wonderful older brother who was dying at the time, and he had to see the movie twice, asking me to join him. And as he was crippled by the cancer that was eating at his brain, he used to sing, "Always look on the bright side of life." And putting his arms outstretched as though he were on a cross, he would do a shuffle dance. And he helped us laugh our way through a tragic moment thanks to you, gentlemen. Thank you for the show. I wish there were more reruns.
That's marvelous. That's very, very nice to hear.
Thank you again.
Humor is important.
Thank you, Gertie. Yeah, helping one brother through the end there. What about reruns? Is it rerun much in the UK these days? Does it get the TV segments come back?
It doesn't get rerun much by the BBC, and I never quite understand this, but it's on a DVD now and all the ancillary sort of activities. I mean, when we started making Python, there was I don't think there was any video around at the time. Maybe a very, very clunky early Philips video was there. But there were no ancillary ways of seeing the show. Once it had gone out, that was that. Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't repeated, you would never see it again. And we sort of take for granted now that you can go down, you can buy a DVD, you can buy a CD of the albums, you can play them when you want, where you want. But it was all very, very different when we were writing the shows. And I think that, interestingly, in the very early stages, we were not sure if the BBC had actually kept any of the Python tapes because they'd used to destroy material. I mean, some wonderful stuff like Peter Cook and Dudley Moore's series, Not Only But Also, almost entirely wiped because they needed the shelf space or something else. So, it could have happened to Python. And very early on, Terry Jones kept all the videos in his cellar, sort of like, rations just in case anything went wrong.
Right.
And we, at one time, we thought this is the only source of Python we've got, but it turned out they had kept them somewhere. But we built in obsolescence was what was the name of the game then. Things didn't last forever.
The performance was there, but we're hearing the humor and some of the sketches today, and the laughter comes right back. It seems to have aged pretty well. Do you agree?
I do, yeah. I still find it funny, and I sometimes feel guilty. Why should we laugh at our own material? But if we're not going to, the people who created it, who will? And the fact it does still make us laugh. And we had a... I think in one way, distance between making the shows and hearing them again helps. We were all very, very critical when the shows were made, and we looked at them and said, oh, that wasn't very well shot, or we could have done that better. We just endless self-criticism. And now, as time has passed, I think we just see what other people see who enjoy it. We had a screening of Life of Brian for the 30th anniversary of Python in 1999 at a big cinema in London. And we were all Pythons lined up in one row, and we just roaring with laughter. I mean, quite embarrassing, really, looking around and thinking we're putting people off here. But wow, we thought it was really funny.
Why not? Let's take a call from Virginia Beach. Amory, you're on the air with Michael Palin.
Michael, hello. How are you?
Hi. I'm very well, thank you.
I wanted to share with you my earliest experience with Monty Python was in the theater as the credits began to roll at the start of Holy Grail.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden we were talking about the Moose's Wardrobe and the stacking of the people in charge of credits. And frankly, my life has never been the same since.
Was she been better or worse?
Infinitely better. My daughter and I have shared Flying Circus and Holy Grail, and it's just a massive lot of fun. And
do you have a question for Michael Amory? Do you have a question? We've got Michael. Do you have a question for him as well?
Yeah, I actually do. Was there a point at which, in the later part of the first season, the second season, where you really knew you were on to something very different?
Yes, I guess there was. At the end of the first series, we were getting some pretty good reviews. A lot of people liked the show, and they just felt it was funny. So we'd achieved.
Any particular breakthrough skit that really caught the attention?
It's a very good question, that, and I can't remember. One is tempted to say, well, the Dead Parrot, which has become the most popular. But I think it was a mixture of things. And I think one, also, Terry Gilliam's animation was very important. The number of people who mentioned the animation the next morning was considerable. That was something that was very, very different.
Terry Gilliam, the only American in your crew.
Yeah, exactly. And very important that he was there, because otherwise it'd be a lot of English college boys without some outsider saying, actually, this can be funny and that can be funny and that wasn't funny. So Terry was very important as a sounding board as well as from the creative side.
And when you did feel that you were onto something big and began to get that feedback, you know, we've seen a lot of bands and groups and the Beatles and you name it, for whom that pressure ultimately was very difficult. Was it difficult for Monty Python?
It was, really. I mean, when I looked at the diaries again, I was surprised the number of times I'd rather gloomily say, this is the end of Python. We've had it. We're not going to do any more.
Yeah.
It's about five times in the first 5 years of the decade I thought we'd had it. John Cleese, first of all, a bit restless, wanted to sort of get away and write what ultimately turned out to be Fawlty Towers. And that was midway through the second series. Then Eric had another offer in the third series. And I thought that was it. And then we made the transition, which was very unusual for a comedy group on television, to movies. And that was really, really important. The fact that we made Holy Grail for very little money, but we made it ourselves. We directed it ourselves. I thought it was shot beautifully, considering the amount of resources we had. And that gave people a new lease of life. But then we had the early screenings, and people didn't seem that enthusiastic. So I write in my diary again, you know, this seems to be the end of Python. We're quibbling about money and all that and all that sort of stuff. And it keeps coming back, but there was no real time until, I suppose, Life of Brian had gone out and in 1978, that we felt we've now got it right. And, of course, as soon as we had it right in 78, that was the beginning of the end.
Of course.
And we only did one movie after that, which was Meaning of Life. And that was it had some very, very good bits in it, but it wasn't as good as Grail or Brian, in my estimation, anyway.
And off it goes. Amory, thanks for your call. Let's take one from Claudia in Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Claudia. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Claudia.
I'm 13, so I'm a little young to be into this sort of stuff. You know, my parents...
No.
Yeah, I find it very funny. But one of my favorite sketches I like to watch is the dead parrot scene, and I was sort of wondering where you got your inspiration from that.
I can tell you, actually, because in 19... Well, about a couple of years before Python, John Cleese and Graham Chapman wrote a show called How to Irritate People. And I've been telling them about this, the guy who looked after my car, the garage man. He was a really sort of a wonderful character, because whatever happened to the car, he'd just say, oh, yeah, well, it's because it's new or something like that. And you take it in, you say, well, the brakes all failed. I ran down the road into a wall, smashed up. He said, oh, bring it in. We'll have it adjusted. Always like that with these new cars. He wouldn't actually accept ever that anything was seriously wrong from the mechanical side. Oh, it's new. Bring it in. We'll readjust it. And I was telling John about this guy, and I said, whatever you do, he's got an answer for it. And John wrote a sketch about this garage man, a car totally falling apart and all the doors falling off. And we did it for How to Irritate People, which is, I think, available on DVD somewhere.
Yeah.
When it came to Python, we liked the character so much, but they felt, we've done the cars, let's have someone complaining about something different, and something
completely different.
Sort of stupid, a sort of animal of some kind. And Graham Chapman suggested a parrot, and it was called a Norwegian blue parrot. And I mean, that was the difference between the rather more conventional sketch we did for How to Irritate People and the surreal, completely sort of crazy idea of the parrot being brought in. But that was the genesis of it.
Oh, Claudia, you enjoy it? It makes you laugh? You're 13 all these years later? Does it get you going?
Yeah.
And it still works for you?
Yeah, it's really funny.
Oh, that's great. Thanks for calling. Let's hear just a little bit of the dead parrot sketch, one of the best known of Monty Python. Cleese, and as an exasperated customer to Michael Palin's shopkeeper here.
I wish to make a complaint.
Sorry, we're closing for lunch.
Never mind that, my lad. I wish to complain about this parrot what I purchased not half an hour ago from this very boutique.
Oh, yes, the Norwegian blue. What's wrong with it?
I'll tell you what's wrong with it. It's dead. That's what's wrong with it.
No, it's resting. Look.
Look, my lad, I know a dead parrot when I see one, and I'm looking at one right now.
No, it's not dead. It's resting.
Resting?
Yeah. Remarkable bird, the Norwegian blue. Beautiful plumage, isn't it?
The plumage don't enter into it. It's stone dead.
No, it's resting.
No, it's just resting. Oh, boy. The parrot, dead parrot sketch. Michael Palin is with us. He's out with a new collection of diaries 1969 to 1979, the Python years. Here's a little bit from an episode of Monty Python's Flying Circus, the TV version, of course. It first came to the BBC in 1969. Here's Michael Palin clad in a sequined leopard print jacket playing a smarmy extortionist host of the program Blackmail.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Blackmail. And to start tonight's program, we go north to Preston in Lancashire and Mrs. Betty Teal. Hello, Mrs. Teal. Now, this is for £15... and it's to stop us revealing the name of your lover in Bolton. So, Mrs. Teal, send us £15 by return of post, please, and your husband Trevor and your lovely children Diane, Janice and Juliet need never know the name of your lover in Bolton.
Your lover in Bolton, and just send in the money. Oh, great fun. Great fun. Michael Palin, you went on to quite a career beyond Monty Python that Americans may not know as well. Give us a sense of the outline of it and what it was like to move on from this once the tent folded.
Well, I had worked with Terry Jones on a series called Ripping Yarns, which was sort of like one half-hour tales, very, very British in a way, of the sort of books we've been brought up with and been around sort of in the 30s and 40s, prison escape stories and all that. And that we'd done nine of those and sort of exhausted them by about, I think, 1980. And then the sort of next few years were movies. I collaborated with Terry Gilliam on the script of Time Bandits and had a small part in it. Then made a movie of my own called The Missionary in 1982. And then did a film with John Cleese, well, Brazil with Terry Gilliam again, mm-hmm. and John Cleese's A Fish Called Wanda in 1987. So it was a sort of decade of making some really, I thought, good movies. I mean, not necessarily because I was in them. I was just lucky to be offered these really good parts. And then after Fish Called Wanda, there was nothing else around like that. And I was asked by the BBC if I would be, if you like, the sort of the victim, the traveller in a new Around the World in 80 Days, which would just take me as a traveller around the world following the route taken by Phileas Fogg and seeing if you could still do it in 80 days without taking aeroplanes or anything like that. Mm. And that was very successful in 89 when it was shown in the UK. And suddenly opened up the world for me. I'd always loved travel. And this kind of travelling and filming as we went, sort of just opening a little window on the world and talking to people and not being judgmental, not having your mind made up, not being particularly political or social or anything like that, just showing the lives of the countries you pass through, has given me some work for the last 18 years. And I've now done 7 of these big documentaries for the BBC, which they've been very successful in the UK with the books as well, but not quite as successful here. But I think people know about them, but they tend to be on different channels each time.
And in all that time and in that work, has Monty Python been a kind of burden behind you or an inspiration? I mean, it's so well known, the lines, people must moan out, bring out your dead to you and again and again. I mean, does that become tiresome or do you get sick of it?
Well, occasionally, I only when people say to me, when are you going to do comedy again? Because comedy informs all the work I do. And certainly in the travel, you very much have to have a sense of humor in your bag. I mean, that's the one thing you need to carry with you around the world. And, my humour that I use for writing Python is very much present in the way I look at the world. So I don't feel there's been a great split. And otherwise, I mean, Python, it's just been very interesting to see it evolve. And I'm very pleased it's still around. If people occasionally come up to me and say, do us your silly walk, it's not that bad. And generally, people come up and say they've really enjoyed it. And thank you, like some of your callers in your program have obviously said what Python meant to them. And that doesn't happen very often. And I feel very fortunate that we get that kind of reaction. And then we've obviously things like Spamalot, which Eric Idle's written over the last few years, has kept us sort of together. And we meet up and we talk to each other. So it's not something I'm trying to turn my back on at all.
What did you think of Spamalot? He calls it the comedic musical. He calls lovingly ripped off from Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Opened on Broadway in 2005. I think it's still running in Vegas or somewhere.
It's still running on Broadway. Yeah,
Broadway as well. London. Okay, okay.
Yeah,
were you all happy for Eric Idle's kind of bringing it back, or did you all feel like, gee, why didn't I think of that? Or are you all in on the money?
No, I mean, we had mixed feelings initially because we'd never had Python material added to or sort of reworked without us being at the center of it. We were very, very protective of Python for many years. Mm-hmm. Absurdly so sometimes. We wouldn't have it, movies, we wouldn't have them dubbed. We always wanted them subtitled because as soon as you change our voice, you miss a lot of the humour. But unfortunately, in certain ways, you have to give in. I mean, in Italy, we couldn't have shown Monty Python unless they dubbed it in Italian. That was the only way. So we said, all right, well, a dubbed Python is better than no Python at all. And so Eric came up with Spamalot, and very much, I think one or two people, should we be doing this? Should we be changing Python in this way? But we were very much persuaded by the wonderful songs he'd written, the new songs and the music that John Dupre had written. And everyone, I think, very happily agreed to go along with it. And I think it's a great show. I think it's a really wonderful way to spend an evening. It's not too difficult to enjoy.
And after the Tonys and the acclaim, do they send you a check as well, Michael Palin? Are you still kind of in on it?
I think so. Not to me personally, but to the various offshore funds.
Oh, yes, of course.
My moon bank and all that. No, we do get some money as we rightly should, but the great thing is that so many people, it's a great night out for people if they come to London and say, oh, we can go see Spamalot, I'll get you some tickets. So it's a way of making friends if you can get people tickets for Spamalot.
That's great. Let's take a call from Eric in Constable, New York. Hi, Eric, you're on the air with Michael Palin.
Hi, Tom, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Michael, I have 2 questions for you and then an experience to relate. Right now, I'm looking out my window, and I have a white cat scolding me. How do you put the cat down?
How do you put the cat down?
And my
you bury it.
And where do you go to apply for a loan to improve your silly walk?
Ah, well, that's a department in London.
Yeah, no doubt.
Behind the hot water pipes, Victoria Station.
My real life experience goes back to Montreal. Born and raised in Montreal. Late Friday night on some August or July evening on a Friday night in 1969, came your show. And I was astounded. A friend of mine and I were watching it. I was then 18. And we were just astounded. Now, my parents, who were from the Depression, they were hardworking people, hardly ever cracked a smile. I convinced my mother, who's now departed, she was then in her late 40s, and I convinced her to stay up and watch this peculiar show from England. And I'd never seen my mother laugh like that. You're talking about a woman who was born in 1922. You think she would have the sensitivity to laugh at Buster Keaton or something like that, but it was an uproar. Here was 11:30 or midnight.
And mom was cracking up.
Laughter.
I like that.
That's great. Did you find a generational response of some kind, Michael, when the humor first came out? I mean, were there generations that just couldn't get it? Clearly not in Eric's house.
Well, I don't know. We found a sort of gender difference. I mean, mostly in England, women didn't like it, to be honest, as much as men. You know, and the number of cab drivers in London have said to me, love your show, wife hates it. So it was really nice and encouraged to hear that Eric's mother enjoyed it so much. That's great.
Let's go to Ben in Acton, Massachusetts. Ben, you're on the air.
Michael, it's such an honor to be on the radio with you, sir. I've been a fan I'm 41 years old. I grew up on Python. Always had you as my favorite Python. I felt you're the most versatile, and I think I identified with sort of the Arthur Pewdie type of character. So
yes.
Great to talk to you.
That's very nice.
Arthur Pewdie, the eternally cuckolded guy.
Exactly. Well, he was, yes. Arthur Pewdie was always that figure in a suit too small for him. Yes.
Yeah.
Very nice. Very boring.
Right. Mm. What's your question, Ben?
Well, I did find that as I was older and watching the same Python skits, that I found myself liking it a little bit less, because I found that some of the sketches seemed to be a bit racist, honestly, definitely sexist, which might account for women that your last caller mentioning, I guess you mentioned it, and even a little homophobic, despite that you had Graham as a cast member as an openly gay man. And I wondered, for one thing, do you agree with me? And if you do, what were some of the conversations around those parts of the skits when you were writing them?
That's great, Ben. What do you say, Michael?
Well, I absolutely sympathize with what Ben feels. I think we were writing, we didn't look for issues to address. We looked for comedy, really. And if there's something that made us laugh, even sometimes because it was, you know, challenging an accepted view or whatever, we would put it in. But there was never any great discussion as whether we should offend someone here or not offend somebody there. But I can see what he means, I'm afraid that's just one person's perception, not something I've generally heard as a reaction to Python, but absolutely understand.
But in 69, 70, 71, at that time, was that sort of in the UK, confining sexual politics or sensitized racial politics, or were you really going in the face of, I don't know, political correctness?
No, there was no political correctness around at the time. In fact, by having gay characters and all that, which of course Graham was gay at the time and was absolutely in favour of all that, it was kind of raising the issue and actually irritating a lot of people who were very, you know, sort of antipathetic towards gays. So in some ways we were sort of saying, well, you know, we're going to have them in a sketch, or even if it's a joke about them, or everybody was joked about in Python, but it's raising the issue rather than ignoring it. But there wasn't a great political agenda of political correctness at the time.
And what about the way the shows were received, I mean, ultimately around the world? Was it very different depending where you played? We mentioned earlier Life of Brian banned in Ireland. Was Monty Python able to play everywhere, or were there some places that just couldn't be accepted, or people didn't get it?
Well, the first series was bought by Pakistan, I was told, who thought it was a circus, and at the end of 13 sent a note back saying there were no clowns, there'd be no sort of performing seals, and nothing took place under a big top. So, you know, they didn't want any more of the shows, thank you very much. At the same time, we did a sale to Yugoslavia. That was the first place that non-English-speaking country that bought Python. And I was recently travelling there for a new travel series on Eastern Europe. And I talked to them about it, and they said Python was really important to them because they were allowed to watch it. And by watching Python, you were sort of, if you like, marking yourself down as someone who was a dissident. I mean, in the mildest of ways, but it was kind of a way of saying, we love the way the English laugh at everything, you know, about their establishment. And by watching this, we are, you know, tacitly laughing at our establishment as well, the communist excesses of the time and all that. And they just said it was a great, great source of inspiration to them. And also they laughed a lot.
A little political tinge right there. Joanne is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Joanne, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm Mr. Phelan.
Hi, Joanne.
I wanted to recount a tale of different tastes in humor. When I was in high school in the mid-70s, I chose, and now for something completely different, to show as the Friday night movie at the high school and received quite a talking to from the principal.
Just a little too different for your high school principal.
Yes. And now I have a 15-year-old son and a 17-year-old daughter. I turned my son on to Monty Python last year. He loves it. My 17-year-old daughter finds it annoying. She just clicks her tongue and cannot understand how her mother is laughing at this.
Makes no sense to her. We love it. Joanne, thanks for that. And let's get one more if we may. Our time is short, Michael, but Hugo's calling from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Hugo, you're on the air.
Hello there.
Hi,
Hugo. I grew up in England. I'm 51 now, so I was 13, 14 when Python was first on. And you were nothing at school on a Wednesday morning if you couldn't repeat everything you guys had said the night before. And the best one of all that has stuck with me forever was the Spanish Inquisition. You come running on at the end. Yeah. Nobody expects, and you see the credits rolling. You went, oh, bugger! Yeah. It was a three-second silence heard around the country. And then everyone my age went, yes!
Yes.
And it was just the most wonderful moment, the sort of thing you're caned for at school.
Hugo, you bring it all back. Let's listen to just a little bit right from that, Michael. If we may, I mean, we've just got a few seconds, we'll come to you. But here is that routine. A man comes to deliver a message. He does not have answers to the recipient's question in the Spanish Inquisition sketch.
I don't know. Mr. Wentworth just told me to come in here and say that there was trouble at the mill, that's all. I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. Our chief weapon is surprise. Surprise and fear. Fear and surprise are two weapons. Our fear and surprise and ruthless efficiency are three weapons. Our fear and surprise and ruthless efficiency and an almost fanatical devotion to the Pope are four. No.
And oh, bugger. And Hugo was thrilled. Michael Palin, great day.
I just wanted to say, Hugo, that oh, bugger was cut in Scotland. The BBC trimmed those two words off the transmission in the Scottish area. So there you go.
A bridge too far. What are you up to next, Michael Palin, or these days?
At the moment, I've just completed another of my tele journeys, a seven-hour series for BBC One, which is comes on in 2 weeks' time, called New Europe, which is about Eastern Europe, really. And there's a book to go with it. And that's taken up the last sort of 18 months of my life. Next year, I'm not quite sure what to do. I'd quite like to do some imaginative stuff again, maybe write another novel.
We'll pray for that and look forward to it. Wonderful to have you with us. Thanks for bringing out the diaries, 69 to 79, the Python years. Michael Palin, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for the memories, as they say.
Thank you. It's been great talking to you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.